Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. We've got a great show. This is our first podcast, so we're going to do some World Cup failure post-morteming. We'll talk about Bruce Arena, Dave Sarakin, Weston McKennie, Jonah Gonzalez, Hugo Perez. We'll discuss what we'd like to see from the new general manager in very general terms. And then we'll get a little newsier and talk about what's happening in MLS, which starts soon.
How you doing, Mr. Bells?
I'm pretty good. Working from home today because I got a sick kid. But this works out well. Thanks for agreeing to do this with me. I think it's going
to
be great.
Absolutely. I'm excited to get into the soccer stuff.
Yeah, should be awesome. So let's get started. Let's go back to September and October, the last four World Cup qualifiers, and try to put that mess to bed. In three of those last four matches, we were garbage. That's why we're not going to Russia. What can we learn from that?
All right, where do you want to start, Bells?
Well, I mean, we've talked off air about playing the young players and how Arena did not do that. And I think you got something to say about that. That hasn't been said a lot, if at all.
Oh, sure.
The, get into that.
The kid, yeah. The 18-year-old. So when Arena announced the rosters for those games, there just wasn't too, everyone's like, oh, no surprises. There are no surprises. And there's always this sort of conventional wisdom that you can't bring in an 18-year-old to an important match. And so no one in the media at least seemed to object to leaving out like a Weston McKennie or Jonathan Gonzalez. Like, it's too big of a game for them. Mm-hmm. And that seems so wrongheaded to me. I think the biggest thing you do is you call up your best players. Through this whole mess, that doesn't seem to be a lesson that's really sunk in for at least, the media side of things. And it doesn't seem to have sunk in on the U.S. soccer side of things. We left really good players off of the roster because we chose sort of, we made some safer arena, made some safer selections.
Yeah.
The conventional wisdom is, and specifically I'm talking about McKennie and Gonzalez here.
Yeah.
There wasn't a big outcry when those guys were left off the roster. It's almost just a given that you can't call up 18-year-olds. You can't have their first cap be an important game.
Right.
And I've never really understood that. Well, is Weston McKennie somehow less able to play than, because he's fresh? What's your thought on this?
So I was kind of one of those who just kind of went along with it, because I thought to myself, first I was pessimistic that Arena was going to do something unconventional in those qualifiers to begin with. But I also just sort of thought, hey, Jonah Gonzalez is really impressive to me. I'd been watching him, through like most of September when those October qualifier rosters were announced. And I thought he was really, really good. But I did recognize, hey, he's still really young. He's only started like five or six games as a professional so far. It is pretty early. And you could argue the same about Weston McKennie. I think he'd started like two or three games before the October qualifiers. To play devil's advocate, I can kind of understand why they weren't called up.
So then here's my response. So you say they started three or four games, but that's the thing right there. They started those games, and that's for Schalke and that's for Monterey. Those teams have championship aspirations in quality leagues. You're talking, certainly the Bundesliga, the biggest league in the world, one of the biggest leagues in the world. That's the answer right there. Like, there wasn't a rash of injuries that led to Schalke scrambling and having to start Weston McKennie. Weston McKennie was in Schalke's plans. Like, Schalke plans to get to the Champions League, and their plan relies on Weston McKennie, if not the nailed-on starter for every game. He's in the rotation. He's going to start every third game for the entire Bundesliga season. Schalke had already evaluated him. They'd assessed him, and they decided he was good enough. And I think for the U.S., when you have players in that category, that has to be your evaluation too. He's good enough. So the question of, is he ready, I think, is answered at that point.
Yeah.
Historically, I think we can look at players in the past who have been playing at that level, you know, like a Dempsey in the Europa League, or a Jermaine Jones in the Champions League, Michael Bradley with Roma. These aren't players on the fringes. Like, anyone who's played at that level, who is involved in that level of play, isn't like a maybe player. Like, they're one of the best players in the pool. The yeah. most recent example being Christian Pulisic, where he comes in at 18 and it's not like, oh, is he ready? It's he's arguably the best player we have, and it didn't take him three camps to become that best player. So yeah. I think to at least not call those players in, I think that's a big mistake. You know, you got to bring in your best players first and foremost. So I think that is the easy thing that Bruce Arena could have done differently.
Yeah, that's a really good point that I hadn't heard before, that basically these clubs are vetting these players for us. And you're right about like Schalke in particular. I mean, you could argue about whether Liga MX is a top shelf league. It's definitely better than MLS. But the Bundesliga is, you know, obviously it's the best attended league in the world, and it's the quality of play is right up there. And Schalke is, you know, they're making no bones about it. They're gunning for a Champions League spot, and they've got a young, ambitious coach who, you know, he loaned Benedikt Hauges, that, like, you know, World Cup center back. I mean, he's not afraid to like shake things up, and he chose to put Weston McKennie on the field regularly in August and September, and chose to do so the rest of the season until he was injured a few weeks ago. McKennie, that is. So yeah, I couldn't agree more, even though I wouldn't have thought about it this way back in October. Same with Gonzalez. That's a team that almost did win the Liga MX Apertura championship. And and then we had, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is the consequences of not calling up Gonzalez go further than just not qualifying. He would have taken that call up, don't you think, in October, and would have played.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, I guess I don't know. I don't know the kid. I don't know his relationship. But going into those games and you know, following the coverage of it since he's made his decision, it seems like at that point he was definitely still in with the United States, and it's hard to imagine that at that point, given what we know, he would have declined a call up.
Yeah. Bummer, 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 well, bummer.
You know, talking about those 18-year-olds again, like we're kind of in a unique spot in the U.S. framework too, where you know, there was now that well-documented missing generation that we have, where you just have this, you know, generally in the cycle, the new kids come up and they'll sort of, the best ones will replace the guys who were on the fringes of the years before. It's not like you know, when new kids come up, they're going to immediately knock out Michael Bradley. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll knock out the players who are just on the edges of the team. With that missing generation, that means there aren't any of those players for these new guys to have to pick off. Like, we're talking about, you know, Weston McKennie wasn't in competition with the best player. There was no Weston McKennie born in 1985 for him to try to have to compete with.
Right.
He's competing with, you know, average players who are past their prime, who are even at their peak, they were never huge influencers on the U.S. national team. So Weston McKennie is up against Dax McCarty.
Yeah, I know you're a big fan of Dax McCarty getting called up for those qualifiers.
I love Dax, and he's had a great career, but he's never, you know, even at his best, he wasn't a World Cup caliber U.S. national team player. Right. So it's baffling to me that he's the guy you're going to call up instead. And, you know, obviously Arena didn't trust McCarty to use him in those must win situations. So I don't know that McKennie would have been the difference in that game. I know a lot of people will say, well, the team that he called up was good enough to win anyway. And they were, you know, we had the players 9 times out of 10. We still probably get a result in Trinidad, and we're now talking about Russia. But it just is such a bizarre approach to national team call-ups, where you say, well, what's the minimum level of quality we need to beat Trinidad? Let's call up that team. It right. just seems like you'd be calling up the best players you have. And then, you know, Pulisic is a perfect case of this, because you could work backwards and say, well, should Pulisic have been called up when he was? His debut was in a do or die qualifier to even get to the hex. We didn't qualify for the hex too comfortably. So
yeah,
there's no real case to make for, there's no historical case to make that you have to wait for, you know, an ideal call-up situation where you bring him in for a friendly and then you bring him in for a Copa America game, whatever it is. Like, you've got to call up the best players you have available. You just don't have the luxury of bringing people along necessarily whenever you the way you want to.
Yeah, whatever his flaws were, and obviously there were plenty of those, Jurgen Klinsmann, it seems to me, probably would have been much quicker to call up McKennie and Gonzalez, you know, as the Pulisic example shows. And I think that's got to be in part because he has a firmer grasp of the concept we were talking about earlier, which is that a club like Schalke is all the vetting you need. And, you know, Klinsmann grew up in Germany. He knows Schalke. He knows the history of that club. And he knows about the Knappenschmied. My pronunciation is probably terrible, but that's their academy.
No, I could hear the umlaut in your...
Thank you. Yeah, I was working on that umlaut. I wonder if you think Klinsmann would have been more aggressive on that.
No question about it. And it's just like you said, there's, you know, he was, if people are saying Weston McKennie shouldn't have been called up for the, you know, if it was right to leave him off the list, then you'd also have to say that Pulisic was called up too soon.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anyone would make that case. And I don't think you need hindsight to make that case. Pulisic is clearly something special, but so is the fact that McKennie's playing for Schalke means so is McKennie. Certainly relative to the current crop of players that we have.
Yeah. He would have slotted in perfectly in that Trinidad game. I mean, not to pour too much salt in the wound, but just to have him in there next to Bradley, I think we easily get a result in that game. So that's partly a tactical mistake on Arena's part, playing with an empty bucket. But hey,
yeah, we can get into the tactics. It's kind of one of those things where now that Arena's gone, it's not that we don't have to debate the tactics too much. He's not going to set the tactics for the future. But yes, the tactics were also a disaster.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about. I want to mention one other young player that I think could have made a difference, and that's Tyler Adams, who is a domestic sort of plays outside, like wing back or right back for the Red Bulls, but also sort of came up as a central midfielder. I look at that Honduras game, the one that we scraped out a draw in, as that was like the worst soccer I've ever seen in my life, the way the U.S. played in that game. And we had Zusi, a 31-year-old, at right back, and DeMarcus Beasley, who's like, what, 48? I don't know. He's really old, at left back. And I don't see Adams just getting repeatedly roasted at right back the way Zusi was by those Honduran wingers. So I think there's another opportunity there that was missed.
I'm with you. I think that, you know, we wait until it's – essentially the national team waits until – it's impossible not to call a kid up. And that's I think, what the situation Tyler Adams was in, where we go with the safe option in Graham Zusi. He's been there before, so we pick him instead. And it's not just that he can get roasted on the outside. It's that he doesn't threaten you on the attack. So those wingers for Honduras are free to go at him, knowing that even if they get beat, so what? He's not going to outrun you down to the other side of the field.
Yeah.
So we lose a lot in both directions to go with the safe option.
Yeah. All right. Well, one, before we move on from this depressing catalog, let's talk a little bit about the Jeff Cameron, what Jeff Cameron said in a New York Times interview. And also he wrote a Players Tribune article, where he said he thought Klinsmann would have qualified the U.S. for Russia. I don't know. What did you take away? Did you take anything away from that interview? Or those that collection of thoughts from Mr. Cameron?
I think there was some good stuff. First, I think he's right. I think Klinsmann would have qualified us for for Russia, but I also think, or I also thought at least that Arena would, because qualifying is so difficult to screw up.
Yeah.
He probably would have. The games Klinsmann lost were home to Mexico and at Costa Rica, and those aren't exactly the easiest games in the hex schedule. So it's almost like those are sort of forgivable points to drop. You don't need those points to qualify. Now, Klinsmann also seemed to have lost the players completely, or lost enough of them that maybe he would have been impossible. Maybe the players sort of were going to, you know, perform out of spite until he was gone. But I think Cameron, you know, at least I think in that sense, he's probably right. Klinsmann didn't cost us qualifying.
Yeah,
I'd say.
Yeah, you wonder if Klinsmann would have sorted things out in the locker room over the Christmas break, whatever you want to call it, and gotten things back on track.
He probably just dumped a bunch of players and picked up the kids.
Yeah, but maybe he would have done that. That would have been awesome. The most interesting thing to me in the interview was Cameron defending himself. Maybe not the most interesting, but interesting was him defending himself for the giveaway late against Costa Rica that he's taken a lot of flack for. He argued it was the game, we were down 1-0. It was the 86th minute and he was trying to make a play. And I think that's a point that hasn't been acknowledged a lot. I was even listening to Brian Strauss from Sports Illustrated in a podcast this morning, and he failed to acknowledge that context. You know, Cameron argues, I didn't lose that game for us. I was trying to make a play late. And, you know, you got to take risks to get a result at that point. And I totally buy that. I mean, then Cameron went and sat, you know, had to sit for the rest of qualifying pretty much. He came on and against Honduras and helped us scratch out that draw, but he didn't play either of the last two games. And Arena pins it on, you know, him not performing well against Costa Rica in part.
Yeah, that's a real like cop out from Arena, because Cameron's spot on there. It's a bad mistake to make, but it's certainly not a you're now benched for the remainder of qualifying caliber of a mistake. What I kind of almost compare it to would be, you know, you're down 1-0 late in the game and you get a corner kick, so you send your goalkeeper up to try to score,
right.
And then if the other team scores on the counter, you're not then going bench the goalkeeper. You know,
right.
You have to press. You've got to press to try to make something happen because time's working against you. And, you know, you can say he made the wrong read or the wrong decision or he failed to execute. Those are all true. But it's not something where if he's been your standout center back that you then say, all right, well, we're going with we're benching you and we're going to take our chances with the backup.
Yeah.
And I think that's one that it didn't take hindsight. It didn't take Omar having a complete howler in the Trinidad game to recognize that.
Yeah, you just watch those two players play, and Cameron is obviously the superior player. He's so much better than Gonzalez at the game of soccer. Yes, I mean, I guess those two sins for me, the one of not calling up the youngsters and the one of benching Cameron, are sort of in stiff competition for what embitters me the most about the end of qualifying. But
you've got those two. You've got the not playing another center mid. And again, these aren't – none of those I don't think are hindsight. I don't think anyone was sitting there waiting until those mistakes materialized to be like, oh, we shouldn't have played Gonzalez. I think there was a lot of – is Cameron still hurt? You know, it was a lot of texting back and forth saying, so what's Cameron's deal? He must still be hurt. He played for England or he played for Stoke last weekend. Is he not hurt? Those weren't – Arena likes to say everyone knows the answers after the game, but – you know, those were well, like, publicized criticisms before the result.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the empty midfield was a problem throughout qualifying, to be frank. I mean, it was even a problem. Well, let's take a break and come back and talk about that, because I think we can sort of fold in a discussion of the general manager hire and a little bit of a bigger picture discussion about the quality of the men's national team. So we'll be right back. I am here, We have a new U.S. soccer president, Carlos Cordero, and we don't have to get into that too much because there are too many takes out there, including some of mine. But he promised to hire general managers for both the men's and women's programs. This is, I think, it seems like a good idea. Somebody responsible for the program. What do you think of this?
All right, I'll get into the technical director. I want to bring up one more thing about the Jeff Cameron article.
Yeah, please.
That I think kind of is at least worth considering. He talks about really wanting players to go to Europe. And I know that was Klinsmann's mantra too. You've got to go challenge yourself. And I think there's definitely something to that. I think one of the challenges for team selection, so this might play into the technical director and the future coach of the national team, is if you're going to encourage players to do that, and then, you know, they challenge themselves at the highest level they can, a lot of them are going to struggle at that level, even if they could have had success in MLS. And then it comes down to, are you going to punish them by way of national team selection? So I think the case that I'm thinking of is like a Bobby Wood versus like a CJ Sapong. And right now it seems like CJ Sapong might have sort of an inside track on U.S. national team selection because Bobby Wood's having a really bad season. Would you say Bobby Wood's having a bad season?
I would agree. Yeah, completely. He had a really nice almost goal on Sunday where he like brought down a deflected cross and then kind of did like a, I don't even know what you call it, kind of like he jumped up and volleyed it.
Yeah, like, yeah. A little like a overhead kick.
Yeah, it was delightful.
But overall, his overall campaign with Hamburg has been, we'll call it subpar.
I mean, it's been abysmal. He's had like, I think, 2 goals in the last 12 months or something. It's very, very, very bad. Very, very bad.
So this becomes the issue when you demand that players go challenge themselves. The state we're in right now, our best forward, the best forwards we have are only good enough to play for the worst teams in the top league. So Bobby Wood is struggling at Hamburg because Hamburg isn't a great team. Mm-hmm. And because Bobby Wood's not an elite striker that's going to take over the Bundesliga. Josie Altidore goes to England and has, you know, a laughable, you know, his stint at Hull was left a lot to be desired.
I'm okay with laughable. I'm okay with laughable. It was really bad. And then he comes back to the MLS and he's a hero. So.
Right, so you can go there and be horrendous. It's not like he suddenly became a better player when he came back to the States. It's just the level of competition you're at. So if you're going to challenge these guys to go across and really compete, and they do, and they're found a little bit wanting at the highest level, so then you say, all right, well, we're not going to call you. We're going to call up this guy who's dominating MLS because he's in form. Well, he's in form because he's playing, you know, he's playing against a slightly less difficult competition. So I just think it's sort of an interesting thing to consider for, you know, roster selection. And is CJ Sapong really ahead of Bobby Wood as far as an ability level, or is he just in form, which might be, you know, the MLS form versus the Bundesliga form? What would CJ Sapong look like if you were playing for Hamburg?
Yeah, he'd look like he's on loan to Dynamo Dresden or something, I think, is what he would look like. That's a really good point. And I guess I don't have a good sense of how sophisticated people in U.S. soccer are about this. You know, you listen to Bob Bradley talk and he clearly has a grasp of the global game. And, you know, like he coached the Egypt national team after he was fired by the U.S. Soccer Federation. He's had a very brief stint at Swansea City. He coached, I think, in Scandinavia, some places. So he, you know, somebody like him, I feel like I would have to really, it'd be hard for me to believe that he doesn't understand this, that Bobby Wood is challenging himself. But then you look at Dave Sarokin, I guess I'm a little more skeptical. Does he understand that? I don't know. And kind of moving to the technical director position.
Are you advocating for Bob Bradley is U.S. men's national team technical director? Is that your endorsement?
I wouldn't hate that, to be honest. What do you think?
I frankly wouldn't either. I think it would be received very poorly. Mm. You know, the sort of at the frothing at the mouth the soccer following, which I guess I'd be a part of. I'm part of that, but
you're always frothing at the mouth.
I think whoever the technical director is will almost have to be somebody a bit of an outsider, because I think otherwise it'll be an outsider to the current U.S. soccer setup. Otherwise, I think the optics of that would be horrendous, to have the most disastrous World Cup campaign in most people's lifetime, and then follow that up with being like, all right, we're just going to then keep this train on the tracks.
Yeah. Yeah, Bradley, it seems to me like he's cool with being in LA, and I think he's really into that project, the LAFC project. But people like, say, Bruce Arena, he doesn't strike me as the kind of like hungry, scrappy sort of person that I would like to see. And I know Bruce Arena is never going to be hired as the general manager, but just as a foil, think of him. And then he seems just too slow and relaxed. I feel like we need our technical director to be just full of nervous energy and, traveling constantly, working hard, preferably someone with no family, with no human attachments, just like working all the time.
An algorithm.
yeah, we need an algorithm, or just like a psychopath for soccer. So hard work and travel seem a lot of travel, a lot of time in Europe, a lot of building relationships with clubs. Yeah, I don't know.
So who's the Mexican technical director that that successfully brought Jonathan Gonzalez into their fold?
His name is Dennis Toclosa. He's actually Dutch.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're imagining someone in that mold? Are you just imagining him? Do you just want him in that role for us? Are we going to poach Mexico's technical director?
Yeah, I don't. Again, I wouldn't hate that. And I think, he's the kind of person who has a sort of broad experience for it. I just don't know I don't know where the overlap is between like who wants the job and who would be good at it. You know, seems like a pretty thin overlap. Don't you think? It's like this long-term administrative project. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, is it a sort of a cross of a bureaucratic job and a soccer job that your most passionate soccer people might feel like it's not enough of the soccer?
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder.
Well, every MLS club has one of these positions on their books, right? So, I mean, U.S. soccer should obviously know what it is they're looking for. I just think that there are probably a lot of people who could do the job. I just think that there's going to be a perception for making sure you don't pick someone who's going to piss off your most passionate fan base.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I think someone outside of the current U.S. soccer family tree.
Does it have to be someone outside of MLS too, do you think?
No, I don't think that needs to be the case at all.
Yeah. Because it does seem like if the technical director is a long-term position, technical director, general manager, whatever, is a long-term position, one of the key tasks of that job is to work with MLS to build a better player pipeline, to get more young players minutes somehow, to I don't know, improve what those MLS teams are getting from their academies somehow. It seems like a big part of it. And if you're totally unfamiliar with the league, it seems like you wouldn't have much success with that.
Right.
But I don't know, Garth Lagerwey doesn't really excite me. I know Seattle's been good the last 2 years, or actually has been good since they came into the league, but they're no fun to watch, and I'm tired of watching Jordan Morris play soccer. And Clint Dempsey has great moments now and then, but he's 35 years old, so I don't know. Lagerwey doesn't give me goosebumps.
I only want a technical director whose first decision is to build the U.S. soccer team around Clint Dempsey. Every everything should be centered around Clint Dempsey and his magical touch. Yeah. I love Dempsey. It will be sad. It's sad that we won't get Clint Dempsey in a national team uniform again.
It is a little sad to be serious about it, but yeah, his days are through. So, I mean, one thing about the tech, do you have any other thoughts on like who the technical director should be?
No, I'm sure I'll be angry when they announce it, but I'm not.
Yeah.
No, I think the fact that we're going to have a technical director is the major piece.
Yeah.
And then as long as it's someone who's sort of outside the current disaster, then I think, you know, at that point, everyone else will just be like, okay, I'm sure that they might be able to do it. It's like any other hire at that level where you won't know if it's a good hire until 5 years down the road.
Right. Yeah. But obviously, because we can't even explain what we want for the position right now. So one thing we can talk about broadly, though, is the sort of style of play that the USMNT has espoused of late. I think even the games that we won in 2017, we kind of got lucky, like that we came at Panama and we came at Honduras at home with that same essentially empty bucket midfield. Because if you put Pulisic at the 10, it sort of turns into an empty bucket because he's just such an attacker and not much of a defensive help. But they just came at it. Maybe I'll just ask you, what did you make of those wins? You know, the 6-0 over Honduras and 4-0 over Panama.
They were just, those were, the Panama one especially, was just this wild, like almost like tactics-free soccer game.
Yeah.
Just like it almost looked like a transition drill that you'd run in training, where Panama tried to run at us, and they did. They got through us a couple of times, but we were just going to get four chances for every chance they got, and that's sort of what it turned into. So the Panama game unless Arena somehow knew that Panama was going to leave themselves vulnerable to that.
Yeah.
It really just happened. Everything went right, and it was. It was an exciting game. I mean, it's sort of that breathless kind of soccer to watch. I don't think that that's going to be in any way a style you can implement long term against all ranges of competition.
Absolutely not. Yeah, and I would say the Honduras game was exactly the same. Their midfield was the opponent's midfield was porous, and when you get Pulisic in transition against CONCACAF opposition, I mean, he's going to make plays. And he did that in both of those games. But all you have to do to stop that is bunker in, which is what Costa Rica did. And kind of
bunker in, kick Pulisic as hard as you can, right? I mean, that's not a bad strategy to stop the U.S. from creating offense.
So I would just say that the tactics from Honduras and Panama in those two games that we won in such lopsided fashion were horse shit, you know? I mean, they really came in and didn't... I would have been mad if I was a supporter of either of those teams at the way they faced us.
I think Panama was... I think there wasn't their post-game press conference essentially like an inquisition? Like,
yeah.
It was... it didn't make any sense. Watching it in real time, I was like, this does not make any sense, but I love it.
Yeah.
No, I don't think the U.S. has had any kind of a coherent style of play in probably since Bob Bradley. For better or worse, Bob Bradley's teams like were definitely of a style, like that you knew what they were trying to do. Everyone looked to be doing the same thing. So that'd be the last U.S. team that I think you could say had a style of play.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to the interview that Hugo Perez gave to this other podcast, Uncle Sam's Soccer Podcast, which I don't know if you listen to it. It doesn't really matter that much. He essentially says, everybody should listen to it. It's a great conversation. But he essentially says he thinks that U.S. soccer from bottom to top doesn't trust players to play creative sort of, he used the word brave soccer, football, brave football. Instead, they value physicality and, you know, height, speed more than they should. He argues that's part of the reason Jonah Gonzalez was never really valued, because Gonzalez's greatest asset is his tactical ability, and that wasn't really ever appreciated. So I sort of wonder if we just need a renewed emphasis on playing soccer, you know, in the Federation. I mean, I know if Arena was sitting here with me, he would say, well, sure, we'd love to play soccer. But you know what I mean? It's like a renewed emphasis on technical, tactical, actual soccer stuff. And maybe that would contribute to a cohesiveness in the national team.
So the sort of the comparison, so are you going to have Jordan Morris or are you going to have Jonathan Gonzalez?
Right.
Like who's, and I know they're not playing the same position. So which player do you value?
Yeah.
And I say, so that last team that had the coherent style, the Bob Bradley era team, I'm sure that that's a team that Jordan Morris would fit on better than Jonathan Gonzalez.
Right. Yeah, that's a dilemma. Because are we ready to be, as a nation, are we ready to play sort of dominant possession soccer against good teams?
Probably not.
Yeah.
I don't know that, and you don't have to get to that level. It doesn't have to be, well, we'll never be Barcelona. No one really can be. Like, you have to have, you know, generational talents at center. You need Iniesta, Busquets, and Xavi to do that. But you can still, you know, bringing in technical players opens up other doors and other styles of play that are just missing from, you know, just to get the strongest kid you can, and you'll win some youth games.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was kind of what Tab Ramos did in the U-20 World Cup when he left Gonzalez off. He, the six that he brought instead of Gonzalez is Derek Jones, who's like 6'3" and, you know, really good in the air. And actually Jones played pretty well in that tournament, but he's not a player of the caliber of Gonzalez by any stretch, not even close. So I don't know. If building a cohesive style means we have to favor physicality over skill, then maybe I don't want a cohesive style, you know.
Well, it's one of those, you know, I'm involved in the youth game enough where everyone in the youth at this point is saying that they're teaching kids how to play, and they are. Everyone's trying to do that, but as soon, you know, almost every coach. Who spends all week saying that, all season saying that, when they get to that one game that they have to win, when they get to their, whether it's, you know, some kind of a meaningful competition where the result now matters, it's always like, oh, now you just have to win. Now, you know, whatever it takes to win, it's a cup game. They'll always talk about that cup atmosphere of this game's trophy. So whatever you need to do, you've just got to win. And it's going to be a scrap and a fight. And that might be true. But there's no reason you can't try to scrap and fight and still continue to play soccer like that. That, I think, is what Perez is talking about when he says you have to be brave, because it does. It takes a lot of courage to know that if you make a mistake here, you could lose your whatever championship you're competing for.
Yeah, that big, fast kid just takes the ball from your center mid who's trying to like turn and play a pass to somebody's feet, and then he takes two touches and just blasts it into the goal. Happens all the time in my indoor league. I'll tell you what.
Are you guys playing a very brave style, Bells?
I try to play a brave style personally. Yeah, we do. You know, we try to play it through the middle, and we get punished for it sometimes, as does everyone.
Right. That's sort of what Perez is getting at. No, I'm totally on board. I'm sure that In sort of that final decision between a really skilled player like Gonzalez and a pretty skilled player who can cover ground a little bit faster and who can jump a little higher and who will out-muscle people a little bit better, I'm sure we're going with the the other choice, the non-Gonzalez player.
Yeah. That seems to be the case right now. I mean, another example, and then we should probably start heading for the exits here, is Ulysses Yanez, who I watched. He's playing with the U18 team last weekend and some friendlies with Costa Rica. He's in the LA Galaxy system. Looks like he's going to kind of struggle to be with the first team this year, even though he's been training with them. He's a very technical, tricky, dangerous left winger, and I think he can play on the right too. He's right-footed. He played 0 minutes at the U17 World Cup in India. He traveled and stood there in street clothes, whereas the winger who got most of the starts in that tournament is a kid named Ayo Akinola, who's in the Toronto program. And he's pretty bad at soccer. I mean, to be honest, he's strong, he's powerful, he's a decent finisher when he gets a good look. But in terms of like combining with teammates and making runs off the ball and finding passes, he was a black hole in India.
Right. The old bit about what do you do for the 89 minutes when you don't have the ball?
Right. Right, he's no good. But, you know, he scored a big goal in that tournament, and he had an assist that was, you know, pretty pedestrian, but it was still an assist. So the John Hackworth, the coach, could look at that and say, "Hey, he did great."
Yep, he's an effective player, right? No, and that's where it's hard to even when all the heat was on the Gonzalez decision, leading up to it even. In our discussions, I was very clear about, like, it's probably better for Gonzalez to play for Mexico, you know, from his standpoint. What's the – not just because Mexico's in the World Cup and we're not, but what are we going to do with Gonzalez? Like, is there any reason for him to think that we will use him well compared to what, you know, his chances would be at Mexico?
Yeah. Yeah, when you say it like that, it just makes me think we got to get, if not a technical director, then a coach who is – just complete outsider, somebody who can look at this with a sort of a blank canvas. And that's what we need. We need to start over.
Yeah, I think that's what it'll be. It'll kind of, or I hope that that's what it is a reset button. And if the reset, and if the new director hits reset and decides that, nope, the U.S. has to just bring in athletic kids and play from there, then I guess maybe that's what we have to live with for another generation, but I'm hopeful that the soccer piece will be weighed a little more heavily.
Yeah. And I will, you know, I'll end with a little note of encouragement. I'm watching those U18s who are coached by a guy named Omid Namazi. They played some brave soccer. They won both of those games against Costa Rica, and they were out there playing ball, you know, kicking the ball around, moving, scoring some nice team goals, and, you know, not just like kicking it far and running after it. It seems like there's a chance in the lower ranks of some change. But,
well, let's full circle. I saw the interview that the U18 coach did, and talking about his player pool, I saw one of his comments was that he was going to bring in a kid from Atletico who was in Atletico's academy, and he said, "I haven't actually seen him yet, but I figure if Atletico thinks he's good enough, we better take a look at him."
Yes, that does bring it full circle. Yeah. I know that I saw that interview too, but it didn't perk up to that the way you did. Good point. All right, well, anything else, Greg? We can talk about MLS another time.
Yeah, we'll get to MLS. I'm sure we'll get to fret about the March call-ups and the friendly against Paraguay.
Yeah. Making the trip down to Raleigh, North Carolina?
I will be not making the trip to Raleigh, North Carolina. I don't know. I'm just going to assume they're going to charge $300 for a corner flag seat. So I'll be skipping the North Carolina trip.
The thought has crossed my mind. My parents live a couple hours away in Asheville, North Carolina, but I'm not going to do it. Not going to do it. All right. Thanks everyone for listening. Thanks, Greg. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks.